series on the icons of Sephardic Jewry. This was supposed to be week 4, but because I was in Israel for a week, it ended up being week 3, with the result that we are learning about Dona Gracia this week. And that just means we'll have to leave Rav Yosef Karo for another time, which is too bad. But so it goes. Dona Gracia is fascinating on a lot of different levels. And what I want to do really is to spend the first part of what we're going to do on history, on her life and what she did, and what it tells us about Jewish life in general of that time. And then to shift over from that and talk about a broader issue which arises from her life, which is the issue of conversos, the status of Jews who were forced to adopt either Islam or Christianity, and their attempts to rejoin the Jewish community, which was something that was very important to Dona Gracia. Just a quick show of hands. How many people here are familiar with Dona Gracia from beforehand? Okay. I'm not surprised that you're familiar. It's not a name that, until I started learning more about this period, which is a while ago now, but until I started learning about it, I had not heard of her. And once I started to learn about her, I was kind of surprised that I hadn't heard about her before. Really a remarkable impact. But let's get to it and see. Before we see Dona Gracia, I'm actually going to start with the first source on your sheet. The sheets are there on a chair in the back. And this source number one is an excerpt from a letter written by the father of the Rambam. We talk about the Rambam a lot, but in English, when they call him, or English, Latin, Greek, whatever, when they call him Maimonides, so there's a Maimon behind that. And Rabbi Maimon, the father of the Rambam, in his day, there were Jews who faced persecution by Muslims, and they were forced to declare loyalty to Islam. There was a sentence that they had to say, accepting the Quran, accepting Muhammad, and it was obviously a major trauma, a major crisis for the Jewish world in those lands. And the Rambam's father wrote to them trying to offer comfort to the Jews who had been forced to accept Islam. And take a look at source number one. He writes, Achenu b'nei Yisrael hanesunim batzara. Hamakom yirachem aleichem b'mehera. I don't know the origin of our song, tefillah, Achenu kobeis Yisrael, but clearly it's very old. Minimum 1,000 years right there. So he says, our brethren, the Jews who are placed in trouble, may Hashem have mercy on you quickly. He says, when Hashem causes troubles for his creations, it's ultimately for a good purpose. Ha'umah Yisraelis, the Jewish nation, asher ba'bachar Hashem mikol ha'umos ha'kadmonios, which Hashem chose from all of the early nations, lo yachlif osav lo yamirah bi'um ba'umah acheres. Hashem is not trading us in for anybody else, not for the Christians, not for the Muslims. V'ha'ikar levlili hi batel min ha'tfilah. And he says, and this is his key point, he says, the essence is, don't stop davening. The fact that you've been forced to make a declaration of Islam does not mean that Hashem has chased you away. You're not rejected. Hashem is interested in hearing from you. And he says, keep on davening. And he says, "V'im mipnei Hamas hameitzik v'ha'ones lo yuchlu lihispalas hatfilah kvo bizmana erev avoker v'tzaharayim." If, because of your oppressors, you are not able to daven the usual davening, shachris min chamariv, yispalu tfilah kitzara. So daven something brief. Ubelvad sheyotziu b'sfasim idei yom b'yomo. Just you should express something on a daily basis. Ki heima b'nei ha'ama Yisraeli uvetarasam yachziku bekerev libam. You should at least say, we are still Jews, we still accept the Torah. The fact that the Rambam's father needs to say this, needs to send this letter, tells us about the mindset of the conversos, of the Jews who were being forced to convert to Islam. Right? What does it tell us about them? About their emotional state? Their religious state?
Many went underground. And in
But what does it tell us about what they're feeling?
Whether they still felt close to, whether they still considered themselves Jews.
Josh?
Despondent.
Right? It says that they called into question, and Izzy, maybe this is what you're saying, they called into question their legitimacy as Jews. They felt like maybe now that's it. We're done. We're gone. We have no hope. And he feels the need to give them what we would call in English, chizuk, right? He feels the need to buck up their spirits and to say, you're not gone. Hashem wants your tefillah. Hashem wants your davening. And that's something that's very, very important, as we're going to see. And it really forms the backdrop for the discussion that that we'll have to have. But first, we have to do some history. So, the circumstances in which Dona Gracia enters the world, she's born in 1510 in Portugal. So that already tells you something. If you know the history of Jews in Portugal, wait a minute, she's born into a Jewish family in Portugal in 1510, something is wrong. But just to give the background before that, to explain why that means something is wrong. The year 1492 is most famous for, please don't say Columbus discovering America. Sorry? Right, the expulsion from Spain, right? The Inquisition's been running for some time by then, but the Jews are expelled from Spain by Ferdinand and Isabella, their gift to the church, in the year 1492. 1496, right, the whole thing, with Tisha B'Av being the time of the decree, correct. 1496, 1497, we see the forced conversion of many of the Portuguese Jews. In general, things weren't wonderful for Jews leading up to that. We know some great families that fled Portugal before that, Abarbanel being one, the family of Rabbi Yosef Caro being another. Initially, King Manuel I orders the expulsion of the Jews. Apparently, it has something to do with him marrying a member of the Spanish royal family. Not going into too much of the detail on that, because every time I do, I get confused. But but at first, it's an order of expulsion, and then he orders thousands of them to go to Lisbon, and Lisbon, they're forced to convert to Christianity. So, when you hit 1510, at that point, you're not going to see publicly identifiable Jews living in Portugal. She's born into a Jewish family that is publicly Christian. The family was originally from Aragon in northeast Spain. They had fled to Portugal in 1492 and then converted in 1497. Her father was Shmuel Nasi. If you look on the sheet after source number one, I gave you a list of the players with their names, both the Jewish name and the name they would have been known by in Portugal. So you've got that there as well. So her father is Shmuel Nasi. He teaches medicine in the University of Lisbon. Her name, her private name, is Gracia, which is parallel to what in Hebrew? Chana. Chana, right. Her name is Chana. So it's unclear how much Jewish education she actually had. Historians disagree as to how much resistance there was among the conversos, among those who had been forced to convert, and how overt it was. It must have varied in the population itself. But it appears from her life story that she had significant commitment to Judaism and likely some level of significant Jewish education. What it was, I can't say beyond that. Phil, if you want to chime in with anything, by the way, at some point to fill in gaps, please.
You said a brief statement about the Jews in Portugal before 1492, before the expulsion. Was there communities before people started from Spain?
There were active communities for a good long time before. It wasn't like they just came from Spain to Portugal and then left.
So you're saying they weren't forced to convert until 1497?
So there were ups and downs that preceded that. It wasn't, like I said, Barbadel's family was there and they left. Rav Yitzchak Caro, earlier than Rav Yosef Caro, was there and left. So no, there was an established community that was there, and there were the ups and downs of it before. I've given shear on that in other contexts, but I didn't bring my notes on it, and I'm afraid of saying something wrong. So I'm not going to go beyond that at this point.
Have Portugal been under the palace? Under the Jerusalem? Or
I believe, yeah, when the Muslims in the year 711 conquer Spain, I think they also conquer in Portugal as well. So yes, it would have been
that's a very strong movement underground, or above, they would say, Ora, Mohammed, and then they say, you, and they kept their own ways quietly.
So, and right, there's a lot to be said about that. I'm going to come back to that if I get there.
Esther, that goes into quite a bit of it.
A book called Esther?
Esther, yeah. It was written by four dentists, actually. They
interesting.
Got
it. The dental underground. So in the year 1528, she marries Tzemach Benvenisti, also known as Francisco Mendes. The Benvenisti family was a prominent family from their days in Spain, in Castilla, and in Aragon. It's a big public Catholic wedding. Some write that she actually had a secret Jewish ceremony with a ksuba as well. They live in Lisbon. Lisbon, actually, I do have in my notes. Lisbon was taken back from the Muslims in the year 1147. It had been the capital of Portugal since the year 1255. It had the first Portuguese university. It's a very serious and prominent city. The family is publicly Catholic, but everybody knows that they are Jewish. It's an open secret that they're Jews. So this fellow, Tzemach Benvenisti, you see him there, Francisco Mendes, he and his brother Mayer, also known as Diogo, run a powerful spice trading company, particularly black pepper, interestingly. They also run a bank. And the bank crosses Europe. It's all around the Mediterranean. And it makes them very powerful because, remember, Portugal needs the spice trade for its economy. Right? When I was in fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade, they taught us all about the explorers from this period who went all around the world. And they told us that it was for the sake of the spice trade. But as a kid, like, you're impressed by explorers who go here, there, and everywhere. And the spice thing is just something you have to learn in order to, you know, get to the fun stuff. But that was actually the driver of what was going on. It's actually very interesting because Don Isaac Abarbanel, in his commentary to the Torah, talks about the explorers. And he ties it into various passages in Tanakh and predictions of Mashiach's arrival. It's fascinating stuff. In the heading for the source sheet, you'll notice I wrote Dona Gracia. I did not write Dona Gracia Mendes. And the reason is because, like many women of means, she did not take her husband's name. So she wasn't Dona Gracia Mendes, although people often do write that. It's not clear to me at what point she gains the honorific of Doña. You know, like Don, but the female version of it. I don't know at what point she gets that. In some places it was restricted so that only nobility had it, but with she and her husband, who were not nobles, it seems to just generally denote some kind of prestige. They were important people. The family was very active in support of Jews, even though, again, they were publicly Christian. So they issued letters of credit to enable fleeing Jews to transfer their funds to their new homes. They bribed the Pope to try to delay the Inquisition in Portugal. It worked, actually. They managed to stall it. The Inquisition, which goes after all the people who had claimed to convert to Christianity but really were living underground as Jews. So they succeeded in delaying it until 1537. It's quite an accomplishment. The family dealt with the royalty of France, England, Spain, Holland, the popes, the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire. Like, they're seriously involved. Right. So why would you stay, Josh asks, why would you stay in Portugal where, you know, you have these difficulties when you have financial connections elsewhere? So ultimately, we're going to see that she does move. I mean, if you look on the timeline that I gave you under biography, you'll see that she is going to move. But while her husband is alive, she stays. And I think a lot of that has to do with family roots and business connections. You know, we see this, you know, not just at that time, but... Yeah, you can look at pre-Holocaust, you know, when things were getting bad. and people knew things were getting bad, and there were Jews who fled at particular moments, not just from Germany, but from the Pale of Settlement, right? You have the 1880s, 1870s, 1880s when people flee. You have the Kishinev pogroms and people flee. And then there are people who stay. You know, we have roots, and this is where our business is, and this is where our community is, and it's hard to pick up and move. Not to mention, I would imagine there's also a level of fear of, what's the point of moving? They're just going to find us wherever we go. You know, the Christians are on the move. They've, you know, at this point, you're past the reconquest of Spain and Portugal by the church. You know, who knows where the next frontier is going to be? Where are you going to go that you're going to be safe? Remember that the Jews who fled ultimately to go to the New World, who went to South America, lived in fear of the Inquisition coming there. You know those shuls that have the sand floors like Curacao? Yeah, so these shuls, I haven't been there, but that's the first thing they tell you whenever somebody goes to visit there, is they went to the shul, and the shul has a sand floor. And they tell you that they wanted a sand floor because if the Inquisition ever came for them, they'd be able, it was either to cover up their tracks or be able to not be heard or whatever the explanation. But it's been reported to me as being a function of that. They were very afraid of the Inquisition, you know, coming over. And then that's when you end up with the Jews fleeing after, you know, if they flee from Brazil and they end up in New York in 1654, right? It's all fear of the Inquisition coming. So maybe part of it is like, where are we going to go anyway? So the Dona Gracia's family is supportive of Jews, even as they live as Christians. 1537, she has a baby daughter, Ana Reina. In 1538, Francisco dies, and Dona Gracia becomes the manager of the Mendes Empire. I'm not clear on how common that would have been, that a widow would have taken over the family business. Much of Europe was governed at that time by Salic law, in which succession to the throne or to a fiefdom was male, right? It would have gone by the males. But number one, I'm not sure that was true in Spain/Portugal. And number two, I'm not sure how it applied to a business as opposed to a throne or a family estate. But what is clear is, with the death of her husband, Portugal became a place that she could not manage, because her husband was powerful enough that the opponents were not, you know, we can't mess with him. But when he died, they looked at his widow and said, yeah, her we can start up with. So she fled to Antwerp, because in Antwerp, her brother-in-law, Diogo, mayor, ran another branch of the family business. So she goes to Antwerp. Antwerp at that time, middle of the 16th century, is the wealthiest city in Europe. It's a hub of sugar refining, trade, banking. All the explorers are working through there. It's under Spanish control, but there's no Inquisition. You did have decrees of persecution for Jews. And Jews have been expelled from there in earlier times. But from the beginning of the 16th century, there are Jews living in Antwerp, and they're known as Jews. So Dona Gracia, from her position in Antwerp, works to enable Jews to get out of Christian lands, not to go to Antwerp, but to go to Ottoman-controlled areas. Because the Ottomans, obviously Muslim rather than Christian, are very, very happy. We know that from the Inquisition. They were very happy to take in Jews. They understood that it would be good for them. So she's actually gets into the business of effectively smuggling Jews on the family's spice ships, so that she is getting Jews out of Portugal to Antwerp on the ship, and then from there, by cart and on foot, over the Alps to Venice. And then from Venice, they go by boat to Greece and Turkey. That's the journey that Jews are taking, enabled by Dona Gracia. That's what she's doing for a few years. In 1542, her brother-in-law Diogo passes away. And at that point, Dona Gracia controls the entire empire. Now, the church had been building a case against Diogo as a Jew for the last few years. After his death, they open posthumous proceedings. They don't care that he's dead. because that's not what they want. They want his business. So they go after the business, and the church agrees to drop the case if she will extend a large interest-free loan to the emperor for 2 years. That's the condition of dropping the case. So it sounds like she's in a good position, but she's not. Because by now, sorry?
Which emperor?
I didn't actually write it down. I'm not sure. I don't remember the name. Yeah, but I don't remember the name at that point. But at this point, keep in mind, she has a daughter who is getting a little bit older. She is now, 5 years old. And when you're 5 years old, in that period of time, when you're from a wealthy family, they start wanting to arrange a marriage. So so they're trying, the wealthy and powerful in the Christian world are trying to arrange marriages with Anna. Because that way, whoever marries Anna is going to get control of this Mendes empire. So even the queen regent of the Netherlands is involved in attempts to marry off Anna to an older Christian man who offers a great deal of money. And at that point, 1544, she says, I got to get out of here. She flees Antwerp, and this time she goes to Venice. She actually goes to Venice with Diogo's widow, her own sister. Right, remember, brother-in-law, right? So she goes with Diogo's widow, Brianda, and with Joseph Nasi, who is the son of her late brother, Shmuel. But there's a whole fight about the estate, and it ends up in court. There's even one source I saw that her sister denounced her as a secret Jew. It gets ugly. The court wants to hold 50% of the estate in escrow for Brianda, the sister's daughter. Gracia says, I'm leaving for Ferrara, where the Duke of Ferrara promises to protect her. Now, Cecil Roth, the historian, writes that in Ferrara she becomes public as a Jew. She drops the whole charade of being a Christian, and she becomes known publicly as a Jew. She reverts to the name Nasi. She supports Jewish causes. He's not 100% sure. It might have been when she went to the Ottoman Empire after that. He's not 100% sure, but he thinks it's already at this point. And frankly, it makes sense because of what I'm going to tell you next. She's left Venice. She's now in Ferrara. And in 1553, there is the publication of a Tanakh known as the Ferrara Bible. The Ferrara Bible is a Ladino Tanakh. Right? If people are familiar with Ladino, right? Ladino, I'm not going to do it justice by saying it's the Sephardic version of Yiddish. It's Judeo-Spanish is what it is. And the goal of publishing a Tanakh in Ladino is to provide Jewish education for conversos, for Jews who are, you know, living in secret as Jews. So there are two editions. One edition is published for the Duke, and another one for the Jewish public, and it's dedicated to her, which supports Roth's idea that at this point she's publicly Jewish, because otherwise what in the world are you doing? They take a look at Roth's description of this in source number 2. This is from his book, A History of the Muranos. I hope you know we don't use the word Muranos, generally speaking. It's a word that when I was growing up, that's the word that everybody used, but apparently it's a significant insult. Usually the favored word instead, yes, correct, it's pig, pig, P-I-G. So the favored words are either conversos or anusim, which means those who were forced to convert. Nonetheless, Roth published this at a time when that word was used, so it's called A History of the Muranos. He writes the following. Naturally, the first requirement of the Muranos was a translation of the Bible. If they're going to learn, they need something to learn from. This was therefore among the earliest products of the Ferrara press, where one based upon the old traditional rendering current among Spanish Jews, literal to a degree, appeared in the same year as the work just mentioned. He had a previous paragraph where he was talking about a different work that I'm not going into. It was published in 2 editions, virtually identical. The one intended for Christian eyes was dedicated to the Duke of Ferrara, bore the date 1553, and purported to have been produced by Duarte Pinel at the expense of, I don't know how to pronounce it, Geronimo, thank you, de Vargas. The other, which was for the Jews, was inscribed to Dona Gracia Mendes, contained a list of the Haftarot, gave the year according to the era of the creation, and furnished the editor and publisher with their Jewish names instead of the Murano counterparts. This edition became classical. It was repeatedly republished in full or in separate books for many years to come. Frequent reissues appeared at Amsterdam, and subsequent revised editions were invariably based on it. It was from the Ferrara Bible that successive generations of the Muranos relearned their Judaism. Later in the same year, another work was published. This is the one that Roth was referring to when he said the same year that another work was published. It's, he had described it in the previous paragraph. This was a prose poem in Portuguese called Consolation for the Tribulations of Israel. That's the English translation of the Portuguese title. And it was a history of the Jewish people. And it appeared under Dona Gracia's auspices and was dedicated to her in these very moving terms. She's there until 1553. 1553, the Sultan invites her to Constantinople, and at that point, she's now in Constantinople, living fully as a Jew. Everybody, you know, knows who she is. She expands the business. She's not just a caretaker running the family shop. She expands into wool, pepper, grain, trading with Venice. Cloth and textiles, which were distributed throughout the Ottoman Empire. Turkish raw products she would export to these other places. She had her own ships. She negotiated with governments directly. And finally, she arranges the marriage of Anna to her nephew, Don Joseph Nasi. So first cousins would have been marrying, which was not all that unusual. At this point, she's very public in her support of Jewish causes. In 1556, there was a group of conversos who tried to live in the Spanish port city of Ancona, and they had assurances from the Pope that they would be allowed to live there. But when they arrived, there was a new Pope in charge. This is Pope Paul IV, and he said, I don't care what my predecessor promised you, I'm not interested. And he sentences them to be burned at the stake because they are, you know, living Jewishly. So she organizes a trade embargo of the port in Ancona, in order to fight this decree by the Pope. She endowed yeshivot in Constantinople, and elsewhere she becomes known, according to Roth, by the title of Signora or Parnassessa, right? A Parnas, the supporter of the community. So she was known as the Parnassessa. I don't know of any other use of that term, Parnassessa. I've seen Pateressa. I haven't seen Parnassessa anywhere else. There's a shul that is named for her. The shul is called La Signora. It's in Turkey. It's in Izmir. Obviously I haven't been, according to the tourism websites, it's the most active synagogue on the street of the synagogues in Izmir, is La Signora, which it wasn't around in her day, to be clear. It's after her time, but it was named for her. I think it's about 200 years old, according to what I've read. She was also extremely Zionist. She tried to lease Yerushalayim from Sultan Suleiman. Right? If you know all the stories about Jews trying to get land in Israel from the Ottomans, before Herzl. I think she's got to be the earliest or among the earliest to try to do that. She doesn't succeed. Suleiman's not interested. But, he says, I do have for you this other place called Tiberias. And so she succeeds in 1558 in leasing Tiberias from Suleiman the Magnificent, in exchange for an increase in tax revenues. The Ottomans had conquered it, but they had nothing to do with it. So I don't know, they weren't forward thinking. You could build hotels there, you could have spas, they just left it. So they rented it out to her. And she begins to rebuild the area's communities to make them available for conversos who will come live there and be able to be Jews. She always wanted to go there. Roth records that her husband was actually buried in Israel, and she had hoped to join him. In the year 1565, there's a Portuguese visitor to the Holy Land who records that the Jewish inhabitants of the land are excited because they believe she's going to be there soon, but it appears that she did not make it. She passed away in 1569 in Constantinople. However, she was buried on Har HaZeitim. She's buried on the Mount of Olives. Interestingly, in New York City, in 2010, they designated a Dona Gracia Day. And in Philadelphia in 2011, for the 500th anniversary of her birthday. The Turkish government sponsored a Dona Gracia evening in New York City, an exhibit in Lisbon. The Israeli Mint produced a commemorative medal. She has a museum in Tveria that's dedicated to her. So this is really, it's an incredible life. And like I said, when I first learned about it, I was like, why did I never know this? But lo and behold, yes. Yes.
Does that mean that she reconciled with
Brianda? Or? I'm not sure. I don't know if that's from Brianda. I think that's from her brother Shmuel.
Okay.
So the answer is not necessarily.
And if Brianda was married to Diogo, wouldn't it make sense for the widow to split?
So I don't know the full details of what the estate battle was.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a good question, but not knowing also how much of it was tied to the fact that Dona Gracia was the one who was really managing it, that could have figured in also. Yeah. Sorry, was I, what?
Yeah, that was it. The sister wanted to manage also.
Uh-huh. Got it.
Not even his brother.
Yeah.
She was the one.
Got it. So that would have led to it. Thank you. Yes.
How was she able to pull off an embargo? Was that Pope a weak Pope at the time? Because they had armies. I mean, so how did she...
So I'll tell you something interesting about popes and their armies.
Well, with Constantinople behind her, they had a lot of ships.
Number one, she's based, it's true, she's based outside of the Pope's control. But also... The popes, throughout this period, had an iffy relationship with the monarchs around Europe. The Christian monarchs. The Christian monarchs obeyed what the pope told them to when they felt that it was in their best interests, which often came because of great pressure from the popes. However, when they felt like the decree of the pope was bad for their lands, then they would regularly flout what the pope told them to. The best example is James of Aragon.
Unless the pope had a bigger arm.
But again, it didn't work that way. I'll give you an example. The two orders that carried out the Inquisition, right? They were the Dominicans and the Franciscans. They were created specifically because the pope needed people who were loyal to him to carry things out. Their fortunes differed depending on what land they were operating in and under what monarch they were operating. It was often the case that monarchs were not going along with the pope. Usually, again, for financial reasons, not for ethical reasons. Yeah. So I wanted to, like I said in the beginning, I wanted to spend a lot of time on her and her history, but I also wanted to talk about this issue of the conversos. And the re-entry of the conversos into the Jewish world. We've seen how important this issue was for Dona Gracia, her efforts to smuggle them to places where they could live as Jews, to forestall the Inquisition, to provide education, to provide, Tiberius for them. It was a very old issue in Judaism. We'll talk about it first among the Sephardim and then among the Ashkenazim. So, we saw that excerpt from the Rambam's father's letter. The Rambam had his own letter called Igeres Hashmad, written to the Jews in Morocco. The Rambam wrote that letter when he was good and angry. I mean, the Rambam never got angry. He wrote, you're not allowed to be angry. But he did say that you could pretend to be angry for a purpose. So I will just say that in his letter, he was pretending to be good and angry. What happened was, there was a certain sage scholar whose name is lost to history, who wrote an open letter to the Jews of Morocco. The Jews have been forced by the Muslims to do this declaration accepting Islam. And this was the Almohads. And some sage had written to them saying, if you do that, you might as well drop Judaism altogether. God doesn't want your mitzvos. You won't be rewarded for your mitzvos. God doesn't want to see you, doesn't want to know from you. You should stop praying. Forget it. It's all over for you. That's what he wrote. And the Rambam was so incensed. I brought you in source number 3, part of it, in translation. The Hebrew is available online. I was going to put it on here, but I just got tired of all the paper. I figured I had enough paper here. But you can find it, and this is, you know, this is just my translation of part of it. It's a 4-part letter. In the first part, he devotes himself to discrediting this first sage, who he doesn't name. And again, we don't know who this was. And he's a little ad hominem. He says, we would respond to the body of this man's statement, even though it is long, weak, and burdensome, were it not for our pity upon the great kindness God performed with us, meaning the power of speech. I have mercy on my power of speech that God gave me. I'm not going to waste it on this. As it is written, God gave man a mouth. It is appropriate for a person to have greater pity upon his power of speech than upon his property, not increasing his speech, minimizing his discussion. It is fitting to know a person should not speak and orate before the nation's ears until he reviews that which he wishes to say once, twice, thrice, and 4 times, studying it well before speaking. That is regarding speech. When a person will engrave it by hand, write it on a book, it will be appropriate for him to review it 1,000 times were it possible. And his point is, this guy didn't review what he was going to say, or he never would have said what he actually said. So part one of this 4-part letter is just, you know, tearing the original guy to pieces. Part two is to say, we are holy people, and you're not allowed to put down Jews. He says, you know, the great pillars of the world, Moshe, Eliyahu, Yeshaya, the Malachim, were punished when they raised just a few words against the Jewish people, right? Moshe said, Vehem lo ya'aminu li, the Jews aren't going to believe me. And as the Medrash teaches, that's why Hashem shows him the sign with a snake, and why Hashem manifests saras on Moshe's hand to say, you spoke inappropriately about the Jews when you said they weren't going to believe me. He says, that happens with Moshe. There's a story with Eliyahu after Har HaCarmel like that. There's a story with Yeshayahu like that, where Hashem punishes each of them for speaking against the Jews. How much more so the lightest of the world's lightweights, this fellow who wrote this letter, who would loose his tongue upon the communities of Israel, sages and their students, Kohanim and Levium, to call them sinners and wicked people and non-Jews and people who are disqualified from testimony, deniers of the God of Israel, .. He says, absolutely not. The Jews are holy people, and how dare you say such a thing about Jews. That's number two. Number three, in part three, he says, of course you get reward for mitzvahs you perform. There are all sorts of wicked people in Tanakh who do one good thing and they get rewarded for it. He gives the example of Ahav ben Omri, who denied God and worshipped idols. The text in Tanakh says there was never another one as bad as Ahav, but he fasted for 2.5 hours when Eliyahu rebuked him, and then the decree upon him was rendered void. God rewards people for their good deeds. If God would give good reward for small good deeds for these well-known heretics, how could God not reward Jews who are forced into shmat and who perform mitzvos in private? He says, of course there is reward. And then in part four, he gives you the rules for Kiddush Hashem. What are the rules when somebody says, either accept our religion or die? And he says something startling. He says, what I have here is part four. He says, no, that in all of the shmadot, all of the forced assimilations of the time of the sages, they were instructed to violate the mitzvot in some action. As the Torah records, they were told not to involve themselves in Torah, not to circumcise their children, to live with their wives when they were nidot. We were forced into an actual avera, a transgression of action. But in this shmad, they're not obligated to do anything, only to speak. All they have to do is say that they accept that the Quran is real and that Muslim is a prophet and that Muhammad is a prophet. One who wishes to fulfill all 613 mitzvot in private may do so without liability. When we are asked whether one should be killed or make this declaration, we tell him to declare it and not be killed. He shouldn't remain in that king's land. Right? He says, don't stay in Morocco when they're forcing you to do this. But until you can leave, sit in your house, engage in your mitzvos in secret. And he says that's the way that they that they ought to live. That's his recommendation. I say that this is remarkable because in source number 4, I brought you what he says in his Mishneh Torah, his work of law. He says, "Bishas hagezera," during the time of a decree, "Vehusha yamod melech rasha kenebuchadnezzar v'chavera v'yigzor gzera al Yisrael levatel dasam o mitzvah in a mitzvos," such as when Nebuchadnezzar and his colleagues decreed upon the Jews to nullify their religion or one of their commandments, when a king arises like that. So at that point, he says, the Jews should in fact be killed. Yehareg ve'al yavor, afilo al achas mishar mitzvos. One should be killed rather than violate any mitzvah of the Torah. Not just the big three that we're familiar with, idolatry, sexual immorality, murder, but any mitzvah. He says a Jew does have to give up his life rather than do this. If this is a time of gezerah, when they're specifically trying to get Jews to leave Judaism. So the question is, how did he write in his letter to the Jews in Morocco that they should make this declaration? So Rabbi Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, the son of Rav Soloveitchik, says that what the Rambam was doing in his letter was not a halachic statement. What he was doing in his letter was simply trying to keep them close. He was trying to help them to ultimately stay close to Judaism in the hope that they'll get out of Morocco and they'll be able to live as Jews. He believed what he wrote when he said there's still value to them, there's still value to their mitzvos. And he wanted to make sure that they would keep at it and not that they should give up hope. He was doing what his father did. The Rambam's letter had a great impact in Sephardic lands, whether Jews lived under Muslim control like in Morocco or Christian control like in Spain. And many Jews chose to observe in secret. They took what the Rambam said seriously. And the Rambam's letter was quoted as halacha. Rabbi Yitzchak ben Sheshet Perfet, the Rivash, writing in the 15th century, I think he's the end of the 15th, quoted the Rambam's letter to argue that Jews who had lived in secret as Christians, who had lived in public as Christians and secretly as Jews, are allowed to testify in a Beis Din. They're not disqualified from functioning as witnesses based on what the Rambam wrote. So it was taken as a serious halachic work in Sephardi communities.
What did the Rambam differentiate between Christianity and Islam?
So I would expect so. But we don't know because he didn't actually write it.
It was recent, like a couple months ago, that said that even, I don't know how accurate it was, but even the Rambam was sort of forced to convert or to at least come out.
Yeah, every once in a while I hear that claim. There's no evidence that I've ever seen to support it.
This article again suggested, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I would suggest that Allah and God, you know, is different than Christianity.
So, yes and no.
It's
definitely different from Christianity because it doesn't anthropomorphize God. It doesn't posit three who are one. All of that is true. However, for the Rambam, any sort of suggestion that a letter of the Torah has been changed or abrogated is heretical, right? We know the Rambam's principles of faith. We know that for any suggestion that there's another prophet who comes along and contradicts Moshe, to the Rambam it's heretical. But the major point is that the Rambam wrote his letter to a Muslim community, you know, to a community living in Morocco. He didn't write it. It wasn't a thing in his day in Spain.
I understand. So he wasn't addressing the conversos. He was addressing...
Correct. So what he would have said is unclear, but I'm inclined to go with what Chaim Soloveitchik said, which is that the Rambam wasn't intending this as a halachic statement. He was intending this to strengthen their spirits. He could have written the same thing to Jews living under Christian control, quite possibly. Quite possibly. But it's a theoretical question. I don't know. On the other hand, Ashkenazi lands were very different in their reaction to forced conversion. They came to it from a very different perspective. They followed the Tanakh model, right? If you think of the book of Daniel, right? Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah refused to bow to the gold statue of Nebuchadnezzar and they're thrown into a furnace. They survive, but they're thrown into a furnace. Daniel continues to daven even when there is a decree that anybody who asks anyone other than the king for anything is going to be thrown to the lions. And he's thrown to the lions. And again, you know, he survives. But but that's the model that Ashkenazi communities followed. So if you take a look at source number 5, you find a striking statement from Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid. Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid is living in Germany at the same time that the Rambam is alive in Egypt. But he has a very different approach. Listen to what he says here in Sefer Chassidim. He says, Yesh Sheneharag al Kiddush Hashem. Some people are killed in honor of Hashem's name. V'yesh tzadikim she'ei neharagin. And then there are righteous people who are not killed. Elameisim bidei shemayim amitoseihem. But they die at the hand of heaven on their beds. They die peacefully. V'ilu hayu b'sh'as hashmad. Had they lived in a shmad situation, hayu neharagin, they would have been killed. Now he says, v'lama yafsidu. Why should they lose out? They didn't have the opportunity to give their lives. Why should they suffer for that? He says, the only thing that they lose is to whatever extent they're happy that they survived. If they're happy that they survived, then they lose a little bit of reward because they wanted to live and they wanted to have children. And those who actually died have a little bit more reward than they do. But that language really, I think, you know, says it all. And it's extremely influential in Ashkenaz. The Maharil in 14th century Germany and Austria has this very interesting discussion. The Or Zarua was an early Ashkenazi authority. And he wrote, if people die, al kiddush Hashem, if they are martyred, we say Kaddish for them. Now, why did the Or Zarua need to say that we say Kaddish for them? Why would I have questioned the fact that we say Kaddish for them? So look at what the Maharil says in source number 6. Vel devar ha-kaddish liyasme ha-kadoshim, liyasme ha-kadoshim, as far as Kaddish, for the orphans of the holy ones, for them to say it. I have not heard what the master, I think he's referring to the Or Zarua, quoted from our holy master, who is the Maharam. But I've heard people say this. I heard people say this, that maybe there's a question, say Kaddish, don't say Kaddish. But it seems obvious to me to say Kaddish for them. Based on mourning, right? It's avelus. It's mourning for them. The for the wicked, it's 12 months. For everybody else, it's 11 months. And he says, of course, it's true. So then, what was the question about? Why was there a question about whether to say Kaddish or not? So his answer, I see it's getting late, so I'm going to abbreviate, but you can see it there. His answer is, because they are, as we see him use here, the Kadoshe Elyon Madrega HaElyona. They are so lofty that there's no purpose of Kaddish for them. There's no point to say Kaddish for them. They don't need Kaddish. That's the argument that he makes for why one would think not to say Kaddish. In source number 7, the Trumas Hadesha in 15th century Austria, he says that he talks about this issue of wanting to die al kiddush Hashem, and then to give you the opposite view, just because I'm trying to push it to race a little bit because I want to get to a couple of things. In source number 8, we find a responsum from the Balei HaTosfos, the grandsons of Rashi. The issue was that there were Anusim, people who have been forced to convert to Christianity during the Crusades. And basically they wanted to bring a claim in court for something. And the ruling was they're disqualified from making a claim in court because they are not trustworthy. They were supposed to give up their lives. That's what's brought in this in the responsum in source number 8. He also quotes a responsum from Rashi that's more lenient, but it was very difficult in the Ashkenazi world for people who had accepted Christianity during the Crusades to be able to come back from it. They had a concept of and a process of tshuva, but it was very difficult to actually be able to carry it out. There was a very high standard. If you take a look at the last source here, number 10, this is what I'll conclude with, because it shows you what happened. I need to fill in one piece of information for you. Rabbeinu Gershom, 10th century Germany, the architect of Ashkenazi Judaism, really. Rabbeinu Gershom had three students. Well, he had many students, but three of his students were the Rebbeim of Rashi. And through that, you get Rashi and Tosfos and everything else that proceeds from there. Rabbeinu Gershom was really the architect of Ashkenazi Judaism. So Rabbeinu Gershom issued a decree saying that if somebody left Judaism because they were forced to accept Christianity and then wants to come back, you're not allowed to remind them of their past. You're not allowed to remind them of their past. The decree was not entirely necessary because it actually is found in the Gemara, the concept of onas devarim. You're not allowed to remind people of their past wrongdoing once they leave it behind. Nonetheless, clearly it was a current issue and he felt he needed to say that. So look at this story in source number 10 from a responsum of Rashi. I'll just read out my English translation in the interest of time. Two families fought. There were two families that were fighting with each other, with attacks and insults. The community caught wind of it and decreed that they not continue thus. One of them jumped up and swore that his family would not accept the decree. They did not cease their attacks. The other one jumped up and reminded him that he had assimilated during the time of Shmat. He said, I know your family. I know what you guys did. Another arose and said, you can't mention that, for it has been decreed, without mentioning who had issued the decree. And Rashi, in his response, says, yeah, that's Rabbeinu Gershom, who said you're not allowed to. But the fact that in the Jewish community, this was going on, that there were people who had lived publicly as Christians and then come back, and that others held it against them and would use it against them, testifies to the problem that was being faced in the Ashkenazi world. This is what in the Sephardi world the Rambam was trying to prevent, and what Dona Gracia was trying to fight, trying to help people to be able to come back. There's a lot more to be said. I gave you at the bottom a list of five books that I'm familiar with that are written about Dona Gracia. Three of them are history, two of them are historical fiction. You know, what it's worth, I don't know. I haven't read either of the historical fiction books, but they're out there. But I think it's worth it for us to know about this. And that's, you know, what I've been saying all along throughout the month of Sephardic Judaism, is it's really important for Ashkenazim to understand that this is part of everybody's heritage as Jews. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.